Hello and welcome to Radio SGN. I am one of your humble hosts, A.V. Eichenbaum, pronouns they, them, and I'm loving every second of it. With me, as per usual, Lindsay Anderson. Lindsay, how are you?
I'm doing good. Your audio is just kind of cutting in and out of my headphones here for a second, so I'm going to be wary of this technical difficulty.
Okay, well, I am coming through clear on my end, it looks like, so I think it might just be your headphones are old and janky.
You can tell they're old because they've got, like, the actual jack on them, the headphone jack.
I still use an iPod Classic, so I'm not a good judge of that.
Do you use it for, like, the retro vintage aesthetic?
No, I use it because it's one of the last bastions of hope that I have when I feel overwhelmed. In a technologically inclined world where every second we are being told how to think and how to behave and notified on our phone, oh, this TikTok person exists. Remember them? They're inviting you to a live stream. Oh, hey, this person on Instagram? They're texting you right now. Oh, hey, this thing that's happening? It's happening. Just remember, right? And, look, I'm not a Luddite by any means. I grew up in the Silicon Valley. I love the benefits of technology, like we can record this show remotely without having to go into the office where everything is crazy loud and overwhelming in the first place. But God, I miss 2010 in a way that I didn't think I would. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I feel like 2010 was like the beginning of my mental illness downfall. I was a fifth grader in 2010. Maybe a fourth grader.
I've always been like this. One of my earlier memories, I was like 6 years old and my neighbor's babysitter was like, "You're being really depressing and you need to go home." But I was like, "Oh, well, you asked how I was. There's no cure for this. It's just something I gotta deal with every day of my life." Speaking of things we gotta deal with, change. It continues to happen in our small community. Magus Books is opening a store in Wallingford. Magus Books has been around forever. It's one of my favorite used bookstores. It's in the U District. And they're opening a store in Wallingford. I hope this doesn't mean that they're going to be moving to Wallingford permanently. I'm hoping it's just an expansion. Do you have any thoughts on this?
You know, it is just an expansion. It's called Magus Annex. So it's kind of just like, you know, a little addition to the store popping up in another neighborhood, and it's to celebrate their 40th anniversary, which is kind of cute.
That is cute. I have a Magus Books hoodie that, again, I like to wear when I'm overwhelmed. So me and that hoodie and my iPod spend a lot of time together late at night. It's a good hoodie. They've got some good merch there, not the least of which is their books. One of the easiest places to find any novel by Italo Calvino, in case there are any Calvino heads out there. Shout out Mr. Palomar heads.
That went over my head, so I'm just gonna smile and pretend I'm not so dumb. I don't know.
You mean an Italian postmodernist Italo Calvino is not on the top of your reading list? Lindsay, what are you doing?
I'm sorry, the philosophy I studied in college was feminist philosophy, not generic dark, the world is doomed. Actually, feminist philosophy is generic dark and the world is doomed, but...
Well, he was a novelist. He wasn't a philosopher. He was just a guy in Italy who fought the fascists and then wrote a fun little book about a guy who feels out of place all the time. Actually, if you want a really good recommendation, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler is one of these books that I just cannot get enough of. It's not necessarily queer canon, but it is a book for readers of all stripes. If you've ever read a book and thought, wow, I enjoy this, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler is about the experience of reading as much as it is a good experience to read.
Nice. Can I plug a couple of books too that aren't...
Absolutely!
Aren't book club books?
Okay, go for it.
Okay. I mean, we do have so many great book club books in the book club, but, you know, a favorite if you're looking for some not quite queer, but definitely queer-coded feminist reads. I love Sula by Toni Morrison. It's about, like, the bond of female friendships. It's really cool. It's a good book. And my all-time favorite book is The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. I don't recommend reading it if you're not in a great headspace because it will make you super fucking depressed. But I think that there's, like, a veil you can read it to, like, interpret it as being about asexuality. And I think that's really cool.
You can find this still on YouTube. Senior year of high school, AP English 4, my friends and I created a 14-minute long short film analyzing The Bell Jar, with a lot of humor. I throw myself in an oven at the end. It's fantastic. It was a lot of fun to make.
That sounds about right. That sounds like the kind of high school projects we used to do. I remember my senior year of high school, it was the year of the Trump-Clinton election. And we had, it was rough. Luckily, I wasn't old enough to vote, so I can on record say that I could not contribute to that one. But we had an assignment to take Christmas carols and like make them into political songs instead. And I had like a full-on masterpiece that was a medley of several different Christmas carols. One of them being "I'm Dreaming of a White Country," sang by Donald Trump with backup of his
wife
and daughter. Yeah.
That's, my heart hurts. Jesus Christ. Well, folks, we got a great show for you. The guest this week is Ingrid Ulry, who is the Region 10 District Director for HHS. We have a lovely little conversation about COVID and about mental health and all sorts of things. So, hey, stick around for that and stick around for so much more after these messages.
Radio SGN is brought to you by...
Hi, this is Dr. V. Hill with V. Hill Family Medicine. Ever wish your doctor knew you by name, understood where you were coming from, and listened to your unique health concerns and worries? I have built just such a practice where the focus is on you and the care delivered is in line with your values and ideals. Learn more about affirming primary care at VHIL Family Medicine. Visit VIGILMD.com or call 253-693-0071.
At Chateau Saint-Michel, their wines are a force for gatherings and conversations to serve the well-being of their consumers, their communities, and their land. Chateau Saint-Michel is a proud ally and supporter of all of their employees and customers within the LGBTQIA+ community. And they aim to create an inclusive environment where everyone is welcome. Plan your next trip to the Chateau by visiting www.ste.michelle.com.
Joining me today via Zoom, she's been the policy director for public health for Seattle and King County, where she dealt with COVID quite a bit. She's written for Public Health Insider. She was the advocacy director for Washington State's Office of AARP. And now she's the HHS regional director for Region 10, which includes Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Alaska, and 272 federally recognized tribes. Not only that, but she's also the first openly gay person to hold that position. Please welcome Ingrid Ulry. Hello. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy day.
Ash, thank you so much. I really appreciate that warm welcome and that introduction.
How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so honored and excited to serve the Biden administration in this role. I was appointed about 1 year ago. And really, my job is to be the front door to HHS for our region, for the states that you mentioned, and all the holding the relationship with our tribes and that government relationship. And, you know, it's a really big federal agency with many, many major components like CMS and all these alphabet soup of acronyms, like all the major public health, healthcare research, social service, and national programs in our country are run out of HHS. So I'm here to be the front door to help make it more accessible and understandable to people here in our region.
And you mentioned it's an appointed position. Is that correct? The Biden administration appointed that to you. And Biden has been touted as one of the most progressive and positive for the LGBTQ plus community presidents of all time, especially coming from the last guy. That's huge. So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about that executive order that he passed a couple months back. How do you feel about that as an LGBTQ person in office?
I think your assessment is correct, right? So from day one, President Biden issued an executive order to prevent and combat discrimination on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation. He created a historically diverse cabinet, as well as appointments of people such as myself representing community, probably the highest ranking LGBTQ plus official that people are aware of in HHS is Admiral Rachel Levine, who is the first openly trans woman to be approved by the Senate for this level of position. So that's super exciting. I did have a chance to host her in Region 10 and have her meet some of our trans leaders here in Washington State, which was super cool. And then, as you mentioned, that in Pride Month of June of this year, President Biden issued an executive order really directing agencies, including HHS, to advance equality for LGBTQ plus individuals. A lot of the direction in that order came to our agency on health and mental health and social service issues.
When it comes to outreach and access to care, I was reading the article that you published in the Public Health Insider in 2019 about LGBTQ folks are more often discriminated against and it's hard to get access to certain folks. We've had doctors on the show before that work in the region, and they say sort of the same thing. How is your office working to change that or to assist folks with access to care?
Great question. Well, I mean, one thing is healthcare coverage, and that's important. So, you know, about a quarter of the people in the state have coverage through the Medicaid program or through the state exchange marketplace coverage, or and on Medicare, even more so. So ensuring that people have access to that coverage is key. We are looking ahead towards the eventual end of the public health emergency. And as part of that, the state will be redetermining people's eligibility for Medicaid. So for all folks on Medicaid, including LGBTQ folks who rely on this program, it's really important to have up-to-date information into the state agencies in advance of those redeterminations. There's a concern of a loss of coverage when the public health emergency ends. Good news is Congress passed what's called the Inflation Reduction Act, which includes fundamental improvements that will help to lower healthcare costs and will enable people, maybe their income has gone up just a little bit, it'll enable them to continue to afford the coverage offered through our Washington State Health Benefits Exchange. That's really key. And then it makes a whole bunch of really meaningful improvements to lower prescription drug costs in Medicare, which is important for a lot of folks. And always, given the disparities that we see in our community of higher rates, well, with HIV medications and also with folks having higher rates of diabetes, heart disease, as well as mental health challenges, this is particularly important to our community.
A lot of folks that I know don't have any sort of coverage in that regard. There's a lot of folks that don't really know how to go about. What kind of advice would you give to folks who want to sign up for Medicaid or Medicare?
Yeah, they can go for Washington State, go online to Health Plan Finder, and that they will get instruction there on how to either sign up for an exchange plan or through Medicaid. But, you know, insurance coverage is great, but it doesn't always ensure access. And especially with the LGBTQ plus community, there's a lot of stigma out there. There's a lot more work we have to do with healthcare providers to ensure that when people, particularly people who are trans, are showing up at a healthcare practice, that they are understood and that their pronouns are honored, that their chosen name can go in their medical record. You know, there's a range to which people have become more aware of how to be welcoming to LGBTQ plus patients in their practices. And that was one of the projects that I was writing about back when I was at Public Health Seattle King County. But this is a national issue, and especially with the emergence of gender affirming care and both the social, emotional, as well as surgical pieces of that. I've been looking at that across Region 10 and talking with folks, especially in places like Alaska and Idaho, where it is harder to access those services. So, you know, coverage is important to have your insurance covered, but also to have LGBTQ plus welcoming providers and to have access to specialty services, including gender affirming care.
What is that like going to Alaska and Idaho and talking with people about gender affirming care? I mean, I'm a non-binary person from California living in a liberal bubble, so I have no sort of frame of reference for that. It must be very different.
I have been incredibly touched and honored to make contact really and build relationship with lesbian, gay, queer, trans folks, in particularly in Idaho and Alaska. It is very different, as you said, than the kind of environment that we have here in the Puget Sound area or Portland area, although I would say Eastern Washington, Eastern Oregon, have some similar issues. What I found is that especially, you know, from the folks in Idaho explaining that they feel very much under attack by some of the state legislation that has been proposed. The access to gender affirming care is far more limited in both those states. The Medicaid programs actually in Washington, Oregon, and Alaska do cover gender affirming care. In Idaho, it's not explicitly called out, but even with the coverage for gender affirming care, again, that doesn't mean you have the access. So often people are needing to travel to centers of excellence, more commonly located here in Washington state, such as the gender affirming care clinic at Children's Hospital, where I had the pleasure of bringing Admiral Rachel Levine, who got to sit down and speak with some of the youth there who are going through transition. So this is, you know, there are pockets of the country for which these issues are even more challenging than others.
And that can't be good on the individual's mental health. It was just Suicide Awareness Month. Longtime listeners of the show will know that I have bipolar too. You know, we're very open about that sort of thing here. How is HHS expanding access to that? People are more open about talking about mental health these days. Has that been helpful, hurtful? Is TikTok getting in the way? What's going on?
I'm so glad you're raising mental health and wellness. President Biden called out in his State of the Union that mental health is the defining health issue of the day. That coming out of COVID, you know, our rates of depression, anxiety, suicidality, overdose have all increased and are especially acute in the LGBTQ plus population. So it's really striking. I was just looking at some of the data on sexual minorities versus sexual majorities. And for mental illness, you know, it's like 51% of people who are, you know, defined as lesbian, gay, or bi have a mental illness versus only 19% of those in the sexual majority. And the same goes for illicit drug use, very, very wide disparities. So it really makes you, it drives to why and what are the drivers of the lifelong discrimination, trauma, stigma? Like, how do we address the underlying issues that are driving high rates of substance use disorder as well as mental health challenges for lesbian, gay, trans folks? And I think that Secretary Javier Becerra of HHS is being very intentional in working with our Assistant Secretary for Substance Use and Mental Health Services Administration, that's called SAMHSA for the acronym, and doing things like ensuring that when grants go out, and SAMHSA is a major source of funding for suicide prevention and mental health programs across the spectrum, is including sexual and gender minority focus in these funding announcements, also addressing the workforce shortage. So this is something that I hear so much about wherever I go, is the dearth of providers across the healthcare system, but especially deep, both in long-term care, but also in behavioral health. And one thing that SAMHSA is doing is providing a list of professional training curricula to improve the health and well-being of the LGBTQ plus population so that our cadre of mental health counselors, therapists, have better resources and training and how to better understand serving LGBTQ plus people. And also, you know, this gets a little more wonky, but data is important too. So across all these federal programs, and the states are working to improve this as well as local health jurisdictions, the extent to which we are really attentive to collecting data that includes sexual orientation questions and SOGI data on sexual orientation, gender identity, we have to see what's happening to know where to target the dollars and the services. So often we are invisible and we don't show in the data. So the more that we can get government entities and providers across the spectrum to include the questions around sexual orientation and gender identity in the data, the more important that is, so that we can work towards solutions.
The problem also seems to be that a lot of folks in our community don't trust the federal government or any sort of government. How do we increase that trust? How do we work towards a better future for everyone so everyone has that level of trust there? Because it seems like if we're not represented in the data, we're not going to get proper access or proper care, and it just keeps cycling, sort of an Ouroboros situation there. Do I have that right? Does that seem to be one of the problems you're facing?
Yes. So I think one of the challenges is, you know, how do we increase trust? How do we support people in addressing not only their clinical healthcare needs, but the determinants in their lives that contribute to health outcomes, mm-hmm. like, you know, food insecurity or paying housing costs. So these social determinants of health are really so important to close disparity gaps. I think it helps when we have leadership in power who are sending strong signals that all are welcome. You know, for example, the president declaring Transgender Visibility Day. And I collected some photos of folks, trans folks here from Washington State, mm-hmm. and other states in our region. And we had sort of a solidarity thing going on social media with Admiral Levine and with their pictures. The idea that you are seen, that you are recognized, and that your rights are being stood up for goes a long way. I know that, you know, in recent weeks and days, this administration and HHS, as well as our Administration for Children and Families, have stated unequivocally that so-called conversion therapy is harmful. Mm-hmm. And in response to some of the activities in other states, stated unequivocally that gender-affirming care is not child abuse, which is what some other state officials have indicated. So I think the more that we have leadership, not only for the LGBTQ plus community, but for communities of color, for American Indian, Alaska Native folks to all feel recognized. You know, we just came last week was Indigenous Peoples Day. Mm-hmm. So I think there's recognition of who we all are in this country and that we are seen, we are heard, and that there's a strong commitment to equity and mental health and physical health for all, the more that will build trust in government.
Let's jump real quick to COVID. Mayor Harrell has just announced that he's going to declare the COVID emergency over in Seattle. You know this territory very well. You worked on COVID response and vaccine rollout. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, COVID is certainly not the disruptive force it previously was. Mm-hmm. However, we still have 350 to 400 people dying per day in the U.S. So I think we have to maximize the use of the tools that we do have in our tool chest. Mm-hmm. And today, the most important tool we have are the newly updated COVID vaccine, otherwise known as the bivalent, updated for the Omicron strain. So important, especially for older adults and people who are immunocompromised, is to take advantage of the protection, because we know that you still may get a COVID infection, but your chances of getting hospitalized or becoming seriously ill or dying are very, very low if you have the full protection of the vaccine. So this is the most, very most important thing at this time that we can do to keep everyone safe.
Well, thank you for that. Are there any parting words you'd like to share? Where should we go online for information? Those will be in our show notes.
Yeah, I really am excited again to share with people any information needed regarding the huge range of health and social services come through HHS. I am being very intentional in reaching out to the LGBTQ plus community. I hosted a convening with nearly 200 people just recently. We covered a lot of issues. We're going to have a lot of follow-up discussion after that. So if people in the LGBTQ plus community would like to connect, my door is open, and I encourage them to also sign up for our regional newsletter, because we do have some upcoming events, including a deeper dive discussion on monkeypox virus, mm-hmm. and a deeper dive discussion on gender affirming care, and a look at how our new 988 suicide and crisis lifeline, how can we attend to that to ensure that the crisis responders understand how to work with LGBTQ plus, especially youth who are calling in great numbers. We have a lot going on that I'd like to share with this community, and I'll send you the follow-up.
Thank you very much. The 988 situation is something that a lot of our listeners and readers have reached out about and do have questions about. Maybe at a later date, we can have you back on and we can dive into that.
Really. That sounds great. Happy to talk more about 988.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again so much for being on the show, and I hope you have a lovely rest of your day.
Ash, thank you very much.
Lindsay, you brought up something during the break that we didn't cover in the paper, but I do want to talk about because it's fascinating to me that it happened at all. It looks like London's Metropolitan Police arrested two people on suspicion of criminal damage and aggravated trespass for throwing Heinz tomato soup at an 1888 work of Vincent van Gogh, or Van Gogh, depending on how pretentious you want to be about it. Sunflowers, one of my favorite paintings.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites too, actually.
Ruined forever.
Well, okay, so the painting is behind glass, so it was not ruined permanently. But yeah, the statement behind the activism was these people being like, this is going to go up in arms, and like everyone's going to be so mad about this because everybody cares more about like priceless art than they do about the planet, which is like also priceless.
God, but picking on Van Gogh, are you fucking kidding me? Like, the guy had a hard enough life. Leave him
alone.
That
is what everybody is saying on TikTok.
Warhol. Go after Warhol with soup. That's art. Modern art. Postmodern art. We're destroying the idea of what art is, man. I fucking love art drama.
I do
this
too.
This is a special interest of mine that I think we do share. Because I grew up a big Banksy fan. I grew up in that time where people were like, who is Banksy? And now we all know it's just some guy.
He's got an exhibit in Seattle, you know. Have you gone?
I went to an art exhibit that featured Banksy-like work recently. My partner has a friend who I guess has like connections in the art scene, and so we went over the summer to the Seattle Art Show, which was just outside the Mariners stadium. You can tell I'm super into sports.
Yeah, the most baseball I watched was a League of Their Own remake because it was super gay and amazing.
That's art. Talk about art. Jeez, a League of Their Own. Holy mackerel.
I haven't seen the original. I've only seen... Are you talking about the new one?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't seen it.
Oh.
I've seen clips. I've been rewatching the first season of Westworld.
Nice. I don't know what Westworld is, actually. Like, is it zombies? Oh.
So it's based on a Michael Crichton film. Michael Crichton's the guy who did Jurassic Park.
Okay.
The books. And then they turned those into movies. But he also directed a film about a theme park. There's a theme with this guy. A theme park that's a Western, but the robots that inhabit it become sentient. And so Westworld, it was sort of poised to become the next Game of Thrones.
Really?
You know, like people were like really excited about it.
Too niche?
Maybe not niche, but like intellectual in a way that Game of Thrones isn't. Anthony Hopkins plays this creator of this park with dark secrets, and he goes on these like what is life rants. Like, I love it.
Mm-hmm. You would.
Yeah, of course I would. I'm a dork. But like, I don't think it carried as much sex appeal as, you know, Game of Thrones or the new thing that just came out, which is Game of Thrones with a bunch of characters we've never heard of. Whatever it is, Dragon Age.
Oh, House of Dragon.
Yeah.
How do I even know this? I don't watch it.
Right, but everyone knows about it because it's like, oh, sexy dragon peeps. But let's talk soup.
Wait, I'm so sorry. Before we get to soup, I want to stay on this topic of sentient robots because I have something very important and very queer that I have to ask. Have you seen the trailer for Megan?
No.
You need to watch it right now.
Okay.
I've been, like, dying over it. Okay.
Megan, there are too many ways to spell Megan.
Oh, so it's spelled M3.
M3GAN. Yeah, that's how you spell it. That's a new one. There are going to be so many kids born in 2024 that are named M3GAN. Okay. Oh, God.
You gotta watch this trailer. It's
okay, here we go. Katie, you lost your parents and you're my niece. Wow, they really got you right in the get-go, huh?
Yeah, this movie, I think it's gonna win an Oscar.
This is clearly a horror film.
Yeah.
It won't win an Oscar if it's a horror film.
Get Out did.
The fuck is this music? Oh God, Megan's also a know-it-all? Why is she dancing? What is... That was stupid. That was... Okay, gang, it's the spooky season. I'm a horror fan. We've been having a lot of fun with Sarah Michelle Fetter's reviews of horror movies, such as Terrifier 2, which just came out, which is a nonsensical gore bath, a splatstick comedy. Whatever I just witnessed with the Megan trailer was unsettling for one reason and one reason only. The dance moves that this android is pulling off while stabbing people are too fluid, and that upset me on a deep, deep level.
Megan slayed while she was slaying.
So she's going to be a Babadook level queer icon when this yeah. movie comes out. We already know this. We're calling it now. When Megan hits theaters, she's going to be everywhere. Okay? Yes. It's a kind of a terrible segue from going to that to the Iranian feminist movement. They don't have the same levels of empowerment, I would argue.
But you know what? If you unleashed Megan in Iran, it would be over. It would be over for those dictators.
I am concerned that you said that because, honestly, I know it to be true in my heart. But we did have a federal official on the show today. So let's talk about Iran because everyone kind of knows what's going on if you pay attention at all. But if you could give just the Sparks Notes version for people who aren't paying attention, and then we could talk about it.
Okay, so about a month ago, 22-year-old Mahsa Amani was murdered in Iran, allegedly murdered. Since 1978, when Iran went through their revolution and Conservative Party came into power, there have been laws regarding women's clothing that have become more and more strict over the last few decades with enforcement, especially as religious extremists have kind of taken more power in the country. And there are these morality police that they're basically like, you know, the bitch dress code woman from your high school that would like send you to change into your PE shorts if your skirt was like above your knees.
A problem I ran into often.
Yeah. It's like that, but like on steroids.
It's a theocratic government, right? It's yeah. Sharia law.
Mm-hmm.
It is such a different way of being, and we try to be accepting of other cultures, and obviously this is not about Islam itself, but about the tyrannical government that is forcing mm-hmm. people to dress a certain way. However you choose to dress is fine, and this is not a statement on anyone's faith.
Mm-hmm.
But before the late 70s, Iran looked a lot like the U.S. did. It's kind of insane to see the shift and how quickly it happened.
Yeah, just because the religious extremists in Iran are Islamic does not mean that Islam is any better or worse than like Christianity or, you know, other religions that we have seen extremist groups rise to power. And I think that there are parallels to Christian extremists in the United States trying to enforce things like religious beliefs on government practice. So in Iran, they have this kind of religious extremism, and this has led to women being forced to wear the hijab in public. And like you were saying, kind of in the early days post-revolution, it was less extreme. It was more if a woman was not dressed conservatively enough, she could be denied service, fired from a job, you know, sent home from school. Now it is the point where if, and this was the case with Mahsa Amani, you are wearing your hijab incorrectly, you can be sent to a detention center to be re-educated on proper conservative dressing for women. And according to records released by her family of the day when she was detained, she, in photographs, was dressed according to the dress codes in Iran, and yet they still took her to this facility in an unmarked van with a couple other women. And at some point between the time she was taken into this van and the evening of this same day, she hit her head somehow, and that has not been confirmed how this happened, but she was rushed to a hospital where she was in a coma and then died the following day. The women in the van and her parents have all alleged that she was beaten by the morality police. However, government officials and the morality police have said that instead her injuries were sustained from an underlying heart condition that the family was apparently unaware of, and that she just had a random heart attack and that's what happened to her. But, you know, regardless of what happened, her death, kind of in the same way that George Floyd's death sparked, you know, a revolution of it, it's less about this one individual person and more about all of the other unnamed people that have gone before them and been mistreated by authority. Women saw themselves in her. They saw their sisters and their daughters and their parents in her, because everybody, almost everybody, it's become a universal experience of these women in Iran have been, you know, taken by morality police or detrimented for the way they dress. And so it's led to these uprisings of feminist revolutions, protests. Women have been burning their hijabs in the street. They are showing their hair, cutting their hair in public. It's a big FU to the police. And in kind of the last few weeks, these protests have grown from just being about a woman's right to choose how she dresses to kind of demands for the dictatorship to step down, demands for equality, not just for women and based on gender, but also LGBTQ people and other minorities in the country. It's become a big movement, and it's also become pretty violent. Police have opened fired on crowds of women. Reports out of the country show that at least 180 people have died, although people participating in these protests that have spoken to international journalists have said that the numbers are actually much higher than that. So that's kind of a spark notes of what's been going on in Iran.
That is a lot to take in. And we were discussing this the other day, but my concern is that whenever something happens in the Middle East, the U.S. decides, oh, it's our job to handle it, and I don't want to go to war with Iran.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the issues, and a lot of Iranian women are speaking out and saying this specifically, that they do not want international interference. They would love support, solidarity. And so, like in Seattle a couple weeks ago, there was a show of solidarity where women gathered at Westlake Center to, you know, just support the feminists in Iran. But yeah, they're saying they don't want international interference, especially because it was international interference in the first place that kind of led to their current regime of dictators being in charge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's U.S. Sanctions that were placed on the country that have led to their economy pretty much collapsing. And that's also been a big factor in what has kind of led some of these people to feel so desperate that they're willing to put their lives on the line because they have nothing to lose at this point.
Well, more power to them. Mm-hmm. And speaking of historical events, it is LGBTQ plus History Month, which we are doing in partnership with the National LGBTQ plus Media Association, which we are a part of. And some of those features are up on our website right now, like the San Francisco Public Library digitizing its LGBTQ archives, including its Harvey Milk holdings, which is huge, and a look at Urvashi Vaid, a voice for liberation and justice. And I did not know a lot about this woman before this piece. It's really cool. She was a lesbian and gay rights activist, and she passed away, unfortunately, in May of 2022 at 63. Yeah, just some quick quotes from her. "The gay rights movement is not a party. It is not a lifestyle. It is not a hairstyle. It is not a fad or a fringe or a sickness. It is not about sin or salvation. The gay rights movement is an integral part of the American promise of freedom." I just love it. You know, it's a shame that she passed of breast cancer, but she also founded the first lesbian super PAC. There is so much to go and check out on our website, sgn.org, or pick up a paper.
Please, I went to hell and back today to drop it off at the libraries.
You were belittled by elderly men.
I was belittled by white elderly men because my car broke down and I had to ask for help. And this man was like, "I call myself a mechanic because I'm always helping women like you. Young women and single mothers." I was just irate. I wanted to tell this man that just because I have a vagina does not mean that I don't know how to take care of my car. It's because I don't care about cars.
I've seen your vehicle. It's like a Toyota?
A Honda Civic.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry. I love the bisexual shitty car experience. My partner has a 20 plus year old Saturn sedan. They don't make them anymore. It's considered a classic car. One of my exes, we were driving along the back roads of the Santa Cruz Mountains, and their car lost its muffler in the middle of the night on a dirt road, and we had to put it back together with a pen and a paper clip, balanced perfectly with, they had a flip phone at the time for light. So it was, I mean, this is 2015, smartphones did exist. We were just poor as hell. So it was, spent a lot of time putting these shit cars back together myself. And I gotta tell you, not worth it. The planet's dying. The only thing good about them is that they can deliver papers properly.
You know, I do have to ask you a question real quick. Yeah. We have mentioned several of your ex-partners on this podcast.
How many are there?
No, I wasn't going to ask how many. I was going to ask, are all of your exes bisexual?
Yeah, except one of them, the jury's out. And frankly, we're probably never going to talk. So, yeah.
I think that you should, like, re-record the, like, all my exes live in Texas, but something about, like...
All my exes love all sexes. Yeah. Yeah, I, whatever it is about me, I've been a lot of people's bisexual awakenings on accident, and I've also just dated a lot of bisexuals and had flings with people who are also bisexuals. I'm like a, you know, I'm into it. I'm glad for it because it is hard to find community as a bisexual. It's also made it really difficult to just like make friends though, I've found, because it's like when you're a single person out in the world and you're still trying to discover who you are, there are people that will find that energy and they will take advantage of it. And I mean, like, I was 18 dating people, like, 5, 6, 7 years older than me.
Very Harry Styles, Olivia Wilde-esque.
I have nothing to say about their relationship, but I know now, for me, it was probably not the healthiest vibe. You know, I was just looking for direction and...
It was giving, like, Taylor Swift the 10-minute version of that one song.
It was giving toxic manipulation and forced polyamory.
Yeah, we don't stand that. Megan would never.
Megan would never. Megan's here to protect you and dance while she stabs a dude.
Yeah. I want to claim Megan as bisexual energy. I don't know. There's just something about... that trailer.
What else we got to talk about here on the show besides my love life?
Gosh, well, you know, it's spooky season. We could get into some books, some spooky books.
Yes, let's do that. Emily Danforth breaks into horror.
Oh my gosh, this was an interview that I was like bragging about to anybody that like reads, I guess. Emily Danforth was like known for this coming of age. I guess it's like technically set in the 90s, but it's pretty contemporary of a book and then a movie. And so this newest book of hers, it's like taking a whole 180 from that. She's like, it's, you know, it's horror, it's gothic, it's kind of fantasy. It is like not Cameron Post at all. And it's so cool that like an author can be so versatile and write a good novel and then like go into another genre and have just another like banger of a novel.
Sorry, I was trying to pay attention, and then I remembered what I said earlier about my love life. No, about how being, I'm like a lot of people's bisexual awakenings, and I feel like that's bragging, but did I am I a hot person? Am I, you don't have to answer that, because this is a job. Have I been hot this whole time?
Would you like me to create a poll on Instagram?
God, no.
You like the Velma. Is that what you're saying?
I am like the Velma, and we should get into that.
I want to get into Velma.
Okay.
No, not in like a dirty way.
Hey, good on ya.
Fred was always my crush, honestly.
God, that's so disappointing.
I know. There's a kid in my preschool class named Freddy, and I had a crush on him just because his name was Freddy, and I loved Scooby-Doo so much, and I was okay.
Well, Fred. Let's finish what you were saying about plain bad heroines, and then we'll talk about Velma, and then we'll be done with the show. You guys don't have to listen to us anymore. And our nonsense.
Until next week. Yeah, so Plain Bad Heroines. It's about like these two BFFs that are like almost a little bit too close, you know, the type. And they are not only obsessed with each other, but they are obsessed with this like kind of horror writer. And the really cool thing that I realized when interviewing Emily Danforth is that this horror writer in the book is not a fictional person. Like, this is a real author that nobody knows about because she just was from the, like, late 1800s, early 1900s, and she was very queer. And that's probably one of the reasons why, you know, people don't know about her. Her one great work was her memoir that she originally wanted to title I Wait for the Devil or something like that. And people were like, you cannot call your memoir like I Await the Devil's Coming. So yeah, that was her, just this badass of a woman.
Mary MacLaine is the inspiration for this person. I Await the Devil's Coming. That would have been a solid...
Right?
Yeah. So let's jump into Velma.
Okay. I know that we maybe have some differing theories on this, but it is of my and a lot of the internet's opinion that Velma is now officially queer, gay. Velma is now officially a lesbian. I know that you believe that the Scooby Gang is polyamorous.
No, Velma has been gay officially since 2010 when Mystery Incorporated, the cartoon, came out and she dated her rival, who then became her girlfriend, canonically.
It was canonically? I don't remember this. And I feel like I was still watching Scooby-Doo in 2010.
Yeah, man. So the thing about this show is there were a lot of hints about gayness, and there were a lot of clips where, like, they were cuddled up on their bed. And they never came out and were like, this is my girlfriend, but they wanted to in a season that didn't air, right?
Okay.
The other thing is, there are hints that Shaggy and Freddy have dated in this same show, where there are lines like, oh, you can call me Fred. People only call me Freddy if we're dating. And then very soon after, in the same episode, Shaggy's like, oh no, Freddy, watch out, right? So.
But then I gotta ask about that Scooby-verse bit, because I've heard Scooby call Fred Freddy. So would we also insinuate then that Fred has dated the dog, Scooby-Doo?
I think that Scooby-Doo is a problematic
animal. We went over this in the meeting.
We did go over this in our writer's meeting this week, but I think that... For whatever reason, Scooby-Doo was given a speech impediment, but Scrappy-Doo, who is not a puppy, but a small dog with a glandular disorder, can speak perfect English.
It's to empower people with speech impediments. Sometimes people have speech impediments and they need to take speech classes, and it's really embarrassing. But then when you have a Great Dane that you can relate to, that's a badass mystery-solving stoner Great Dane, you're like, damn, I'm okay. And you know, That might be speaking from personal experiences. Who knows?
I mean, honestly, Scooby-Doo and the Witch's Ghost, a classic of 20th century cinema. The Hex Girls, I'm a big fan. The fucking librarian hottie, who Velma has a crush on there. See, so in those older films, she's bisexual. But now she's canonically...
A lesbian, yeah.
And I appreciate the evolution of the character and the exploration... of this. Also, this is separate from the Mindy Kaling joint that is just called Velma.
But Velma's also a lesbian in Velma.
She is also a lesbian in Velma, and they got rid of Scooby, which I'm a fan of.
They also made Shaggy black. Daphne is Asian, and Velma is Indian.
See, and I know that there are probably people out there getting upset about these things, and while I don't care, and I don't think people should care about these characters changing ethnicity. And it's great that there's like more representation. I can see why they're doing it. They're also cartoons.
Yeah.
You know, and as much as I have a lot of opinions about cartoons, I know at the end of the day, it doesn't fucking matter. Right? It matters to the people that watch them. And it matters because it's good to feel represented positively. But... at the end of the day, whether or not I think that the entire Goof Troop posse is a look at lower middle class heroism every day in a segregated Disney society or not, whether I feel that way or not, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter because it's really just a ploy to make money for these big corporations that are going to be selling, you know, black Shaggy backpacks at Great America. And Six Flags.
And you can bet your bottom dollar I'm gonna have one. The child in me is living for an adult Scooby-Doo. Especially because, did you know, the live-action ones were supposed to be, like, rated R. They were supposed to be, like, adult movies. And I am so mad that they cut some... So Velma was gonna be a lesbian in that, but they cut it.
They changed it to that, like, soul patch guy.
I know,
like,
I hated
most
him.
Basic. And then they had... Seth Green is in the second one as, like, the love interest slash villain.
Oh,
and Velma, like, wears this... She wears one of Daphne's...
The leather outfit.
Leather things, and it's like...
That was like everyone's sexual awakening.
Okay. I mean, I was older than that by that point. I just thought I was like dumb.
Six.
Good for you.
Thank you. But yeah, so she was going to be gay then. They were going to have Shaggy, like, outwardly a stoner. And, like, his love interest is named Mary Jane. So, like, there's, you know, lingering things
they
there.
They definitely had him as out. Like, there's smoke involved and stuff. The fart jokes, I think, would have made it not an adult film anyway.
What, are you saying adult films don't have fart jokes?
I'm saying that adult films don't need them because hopefully they're written better.
It depends on what kind of adult films we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah, I guess the way we're phrasing this does sound overtly sexual, but I mean just movies that are PG-13 plus.
Yeah, there's a lot of good fart jokes in PG-13 movies, I think, but you're right, it does make it a bit more childish. Adults don't fart.
I would argue there's no such thing as like a well-written fart joke. If we're talking just pure theory of comedy.
Well, stay tuned for next week when I bring to the table a well-written fart joke.
Stay tuned for next week where we have Haley Graves on the show, and we talk about all sorts of stuff that's coming up for us now, in the now, and then it'll be in the past, because that's how time functions as we perceive it.
We will probably talk about Velma again next week.
Yeah, you can bet on it. We'll definitely talk about Velma again next week. It's going to be an ongoing theme for the foreseeable. Buckle up, Buttercup. Thank you guys so much for listening to Radio SGN. You can support us by going to sgn.org and pressing that donate button. You can find us online wherever you pick up podcasts. If you like us, go ahead and give us that 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you hate us, go ahead and give that 5-star review to us anyway to trick your enemies into listening to us, because that's what we want.
Yeah, and if you work for Hanna-Barbera, consider sponsoring us, because we're giving you a lot of free content here.
Hanna-Barbera, please sponsor us. We appreciate the work you've been putting in. You're showing up in the space. Just reach out. Any representative. We're basically cartoon characters in our own right. Thank you so much for listening. This has been your half hour to 45 minutes of queerness. And we love you. We appreciate you. And we'll see you in the funny pages.
I don't know why I waved.
Radio SGN is hosted by A.V. Eichenbaum and Lindsay Anderson, and produced by A.V. Eichenbaum. Music for this show was provided by T.R.G. Banks and Jesse Spillane, or was provided for free by Anchor. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out on sgn.org or wherever you find podcasts.